Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world.
So this is Clericalism and Clerical Abuse with me, Joseph Shaw, speaking. The Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, the IICSA, which has hogged the headlines for a certain period, was presented when it was in its evidence-gathering phase with a letter by Aidan Bellinger, who had been Abbot of Downside from 2006 to 2014. And this letter wasn't intended for publication or anything. It was just a letter he'd sent to someone else who submitted it as a piece of evidence. So Bellinger, in this letter, said, among other things, and I quote, "At the heart of the darkness in the community is the issue of child abuse, which was tolerated by all my predecessors as abbot. I am particularly concerned that Abbot Richard Yeo," that is his immediate predecessor, "who should have known better, attempted to protect Nicholas and Dunstan when he should have been protecting their victims." Downside Abbey, of course, at that time, was running a school, sort of secondary school age children. The problem of clerical abuse is sadly not limited to Downside Abbey or the English Benedictine congregation or the Catholic Church, and it's not limited to religious groups in general. Nevertheless, the need to confront the issue as Catholics is incumbent upon us, just as members of other organisations and communities need to confront it for their own communities, and we also need to understand it, since it is an important aspect of the crisis of the Church. Furthermore, as traditional Catholics, we need to address attempts to blame it on traditional Catholic spirituality. So that's my motivation in this. In the opening sections of this talk, I will address the putative connection with traditional spirituality, which relies on the notion of clericalism. I will then try to describe in general terms how abuse has tended to play out in the church and how this was influenced by changing attitudes to sexual morality. I will then extend this analysis to encompass non-sexual forms of abuse. Finally, I will attempt to offer an account of abuse within the church, which, unlike many others, actually explains what needs to be explained. And what I think needs to be explained is why bishops and religious superiors not only allowed abuse to continue, but in many cases facilitated it. So the first section is abuse and the authoritarian personality. For a long time, a pronounced media narrative about clerical abuse was in operation, which had it that clerical abuse was a problem caused by conservatives. This was suggested naturally enough by the idea, which I explained in a past Iota Unum talk, and also in a past earlier chapter of the book, which evolved into, and that political and religious conservatism, including a belief in traditional sexual prohibitions, is the manifestation of a disordered sexuality. So this is Theodore Adorno's theory of the authoritarian personality. Since I have addressed Adorno's theory elsewhere, here I will simply observe that this narrative has taken a battering from the facts. It turns out that college athletics coaches, the Boy Scouts, the British Broadcasting Company and Hollywood have also harboured sexual abuse on a large scale. Since these are hardly bastions of sexual repression, the argument loses its force. That is not to say that abusers cannot be found among theological and liturgical conservatives and traditionalists. Abusers can be found, unfortunately, wherever there are opportunities for abuse. The question is whether a theoretical or empirical connection can be made between a proclivity to abuse and some theological position or other. So, abuse and the theology of the priesthood. Another attempt to make this link is to link it with the prestige of the priesthood. Thus, a letter in a tablet, this is from 2011, criticising the founders of the Confraternity of Catholic Clergy, lambasted, and I quote, "the theologically dubious description of the priest as being an image of Christ," unquote, which the author claimed is, and I quote again, "a power-focused self-definition that has in part contributed to the abuse of power within the priesthood, including sexual abuse of children," unquote. This connects a particular theological position, the traditional one, with clericalism and with abuse. Anything which increases the prestige of priests can make it more difficult for victims to make accusations against them and to get people to believe those accusations. That much is obviously true. But before going further, we need to define clericalism. I would suggest that clericalism is the phenomenon of the clergy impinging on the proper sphere of the laity. The Second Vatican Council expressed the lay role of the Church as follows, quote, "The laity must take up the restoration of the temporal order, ordo temporalis, as their own special task. Led by the light of the gospel and the mind of the Church, and motivated by Christian charity, they must act directly and in a definite way in the temporal sphere," unquote. This was not an innovation by the council. It follows in essence from the ancient principle of Gelasian diarchy. As Pope Gelasius wrote in the 5th century, the Pope and the hierarchy in general are the spiritual leaders of Catholics. The emperor and the lay rulers in general are the temporal rulers. The sharing of responsibilities within the Catholic community can, however, become unbalanced as a result of historical contingencies. Thus, following the British conquest of Quebec from France in 1763, much of the lay Catholic leadership of the French community there returned to France, creating a vacuum which could only be filled by the clergy. The clergy, of course, were in very plentiful supply following the French Revolution, so the place just filled up with French clergy. A similar shortage of educated lay Catholics existed in Ireland and to a certain extent in the United States of America and in Britain in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In all these countries, conflicts arose between clergy and laity over the control of Catholic institutions with temporal aims, such as schools and hospitals. A well-known example is the huge row sparked by John Henry Newman over consulting the laity about Catholic schools when he was the editor of The Rambler in 1867. It was tempting for the clergy in these contexts to assume that the influence they had gained as a matter of historical circumstances was due to them as a matter of principle. This is a mistake we must not make ourselves. The paradox of clericalism is that the desire to wrest temporal authority from lay control is a worldly attitude. And a worldly attitude undermines the real dignity of the clergy by diminishing the importance of what they really do have by right, which is authority over spiritual things. In a similar way, it is common to see liberal Catholics saying that lay people should have more control over the hierarchical church, or that women be ordained priests as the only way in which they can be given a share of power within the church. This is a clericalist attitude which diminishes the role of the laity as laity, seeming to take for granted the clericalist idea that all power in the Catholic community should be wielded by the clergy. Traditional theology, either of the role of the hierarchy or of priestly identity, emphasizes what is distinct about the priesthood, which is not power over temporal matters, but an identification with the spiritual sphere. Section 3, clericalism and networks of abuse. The question remains whether and how clericalism is related to clerical abuse. One hypothesis already mentioned is that by artificially elevating the prestige of the clergy, it makes it more difficult to call them to account for abusive behaviour. Related to this is a clubbish attitude in which clergy protect each other from criticism. Philip Lawler describes how John Cardinal O'Connor ran the Diocese of Boston during his long tenure, which covered most of the first half of the 20th century. So here's a quotation from Lawler. "Pastors were expected to run their parishes the way the cardinal ran the archdiocese, efficiently, decisively, avoiding all friction. pastors who handled these responsibilities well were accorded a great deal of autonomy. They could make their own decisions about parish finances, programmes and personnel, provided they did not violate the general policies of the archdiocese. If a conflict arose between the priest and the parishioner, the archdiocese invariably sided with the pastor. So the system arose in which complaints from the laity were funneled first through pastors, with priests protecting each other against any interference that came from outside the clerical ranks. That's Lawler. The parallel with the way the clerical abuse complaints have been handled is obvious, but there are a number of complications to be noted. The first is that it is not only possible but natural to combine a high level of respect for an office or a class of persons with highly restrictive entry requirements, coupled with a demand for higher standards of behaviour for those admitted to the class, enforced by greater than normal scrutiny. Traditional monastic communities exemplify this, as do elite military units. What we find with the clergy in the era of clerical abuse is the slackening of entry requirements, standards, and scrutiny. A second complication is that while it is convenient to talk about the abuse of the laity by the clergy in Catholic institutions, the reality is not so neat and tidy. Younger members of the clergy and seminarians have been among the victims of abuse. The Christian Brothers, many of whose educational institutions were notoriously abusive, is a religious order whose members are not ordained and are therefore not clerics. Religious sisters have been both victims and perpetrators of abuse, as have many lay employees and volunteers in church institutions. Abusers tolerated by the institutional church have not always been clerics, and victims have not always been lay. A third point follows from this. It is commonly assumed that the clerical abuse crisis is a matter of a series of individuals who fall to the temptations of the flesh and are subsequently wrongly protected. The most common explanations of why bishops and other superiors protect them include the abuser's clerical dignity, the scandal their fall from grace would cause to the faithful, and the harm their exposure would do to the reputation of the church. An extra reason is sometimes suggested that bishops and superiors may themselves be morally compromised and therefore subject to explicit or implicit blackmail. None of these explanations fits the facts, however, because what needs to be explained is not excessive risk aversion, but excessive risk tolerance. Consider the standard clerical abuse scenario from the 1960s to the 2000s. A priest abuser generates complaints in a parish. Eventually, there are threats to go to the police or to the press. The bishop responds by moving the priest to a new parish where the same thing happens all over again. Not only does this sequence of events get repeated an indefinite number of times with the same priest, but the bishop is simultaneously following the same procedure with other priests and dealing with the consequences of this policy being implemented by his predecessor. In this context, it is impossible to claim that the bishops in these cases simply do not realise that the abuse would be repeated. And yet, instead of keeping a lid on the scandal by quietly putting the priest somewhere abuse is genuinely impossible, retirement, a desk job, academic studies, or whatever, these bishops kept moving abusers around parishes and similar roles until a scandal ended up in court with calamitous but wholly predictable consequences. Sometimes bishops' behaviour goes even further than this. The journalist J.D. Flynn gives the example of Father David Svatkovsky, S.C.J., of Allentown, one of the dioceses featured in the shocking 2018 Pennsylvania grand jury report into clerical abuse. Flynn notes that Svatkovsky had been charged with the sexual assault of a minor in 2011. The incident took place in the street and there were witnesses, but the female victim did not press charges. Perhaps she assumed that as a priest, Svatkovsky would face serious sanctions from his superiors. However, he did not. Instead, his bishop, Thomas Welsh, appointed him to the diocese's formation team to work with young men aspiring to the priesthood. And that is not all. And I quote here from Flynn. 3 years after facing criminal charges for sexually assaulting a child, he was permitted by the Bishop of Allentown to serve as the canon lawyer, the procurator and advocate in technical terms, for Father Michael Lawrence, a priest accused of sexually assaulting two adolescent boys, unquote. This is not the behaviour of a bishop whose overriding concern is the preservation of his or the church's reputation. Nevertheless, this bishop was not insane. This pattern of behaviour does have an explanation, which emerges clearly with some of the more comprehensive reports, like that of the Pennsylvania Grand Jury, but can also be seen as smaller incidents. Let me explain through the perspective of my personal experience. A priest, whom I shall call Bernard, once complained to me about another member of his religious community who was a notorious bully. Let's call him Leo. Leo had long held an important position which had enabled him to dominate a large number of subordinates, and on retirement from this he was given another position where, as things were working out at the time of this conversation, he was able to continue his abusive behaviour, albeit on a smaller scale. Bernard remarked to me that it was as if their superior had decided to make available to this man an opportunity to continue his abuse, offering up to him a new set of potential victims, and I quote, like a great plate of meat. This expression has stayed with me particularly because Bernard was himself an abuser, though his preferred form of abuse was not emotional but sexual, directed at boys and young men. The two priests hated each other, but they were in the same position, having come to the end of the possibilities of abuse in one institutional context. They were provided with another, an opportunity neither neglected. The bishops and superiors involved in such decisions are not sacrificing the interests of abuse victims because they are frightened of exposure. On the contrary, they are risking exposure in order to provide abusers with fresh opportunities to abuse, like a great plate of meat. The bishops and superiors who were doing this would not express it in quite these terms. They would say that they wanted to find a role for their priests towards whom they feel an obligation, which would employ their talents and make them happy. Nevertheless, what we have here is not merely a failure to combat the problem with sufficient vigour. It is an abusive institution, an abusive network, whose objective is to find and exploit opportunities for abuse for its members. A particularly chilling illustration of the systematic and self-confident nature of an abusive network is given by one of the cases investigated by the Pennsylvania Grand Jury. This involved George, who, as a minor, was photographed naked by a group of priests, and I quote from the Grand Jury report. George recalled that each of these priests had a group of favoured boys who they would take on trips. The boys received gifts, specifically gold cross necklaces. George stated, as a quotation from George, he, a priest called Zerwas, had told me that they, the priests, would give their boys, their altar boys or their favourite boys, these crosses. So he gave me a big gold cross to wear, unquote. The grand jury observed that these crosses served another purpose beyond the grooming of the victims. They were a visible designation that the children were victims of sexual abuse. They were a signal to other predators that the children had been desensitized to sexual abuse and were optimal targets for further victimization. Unquote. It is not pleasant to write that major parts of the Catholic Church as a human institution have been instrumentalized for a criminal conspiracy. This is, however, the truth of the matter. Section 4, abuse and sexual morality. It would seem that at a certain point, the Cardinal O'Connor-style clericalist system of ignoring complaints was captured and utilised for systematic sexual abuse. Exactly how this happened, no doubt varied from place to place, but a crucial step was a transformation in the official attitude towards sexual morality. Abusers want their victims to go along with the abuse, and the first thing they do to groom a potential victim is to attempt to normalise abusive behaviour. They typically tell their victims that what they want to do to them is not wrong. If they are saying this behind closed doors, it is not surprising to hear them commonly arguing something along the same lines in public as well. Thus, Father Thomas Philippe OP, the French Dominican who was the friend and mentor of Jean Vanier, was given a canonical trial for some of his crimes in 1956. One of the victims quoted Philippe's theological rationalisation for his abuse, and I quote, "When one arrives at perfect love, everything is lawful, for there is no more sin." Father Joseph Quigley of the Archdiocese of Birmingham, England, was convicted of sexual activity with a child, sexual assault, false imprisonment — he liked to lock children in a crypt — and cruelty. The crimes took place between the 1990s and 2008. He was the author of the Archdiocese's controversial programme of sex education, All That I Am, published in 2004, right in the middle of his period of abuse. Defending his programme against conservative critics, he said, and I quote, "If we talk about sexuality as a gift, clearly we want to introduce them to that at an appropriate level." Bishop Kieran Connery, who had multiple affairs with emotionally vulnerable women in his Diocese of Arundel and Brighton, England, resigned in September 2014, and he says in his own defence, and I quote, "I have been very careful not to make sexual immorality a priority," talking about his preaching. "For the sake of balance, consider the case of a priest who presented himself as a traditionalist, Father Carlos Urrutigoiti." There are two kinds of researchers on this subject in the world: ones who know how to spell Urrutigoiti and ones who do not. If you know how to spell it, then Google is your friend. When explaining to his victims and later to the wider public why he had been sharing beds with boys at the school he was running in 2001, he played down the seriousness of the matter. Statements from members of his order, the Society of St. John, pointed to the historical practice of family members sharing beds. Urrutigoiti was suggesting that those seeking to hold him to standard sexual mores were excessively uptight. Indeed, what else could he have said to reassure his victims? And, once the facts had been established by witnesses, what other defence was open to him? Not only is it natural for abusive clergy to play down the prohibitions of traditional sexual morality, so it is natural for them to play down their clerical aloofness. The abuser priest who prepared me for confirmation at Ampleforth back in the 1980s took his little group of confirmandi on a retreat away from the school, where we spent the night. In the evening, he enjoyed chasing some of the boys around the ground. It struck me as a bit odd at the time. But then, that was the kind of priest he was. Of course it was. It's the kind of that kind of priest, informal, down with the kids, open to larking about with the boys, who is going to be able to find opportunities for abuse most easily, not the stuffy ones, with a strong sense of their clerical identity. The connection between abuse and the progressive theology of sexuality can be illustrated at the institutional level. In 1947, Father Gerald Fitzgerald founded the Servants of the Paraclete in the USA to help priests suffering from a variety of psychological problems. He warned bishops who sent sex abusers to him that these priests should not be returned to ministry, writing, I quote, "Charity to the mystical body should take precedence over charity to the individual," unquote. This policy was overturned in the 1960s because it did not sit well with progressive views of sexuality, which had invaded the church from secular sources. In the same decade, the American bishops commissioned a study on the state of the presbyterate. The Kennedy Report, by a priest with psychological training, Father Eugene Kennedy, was delivered in 1972. It ignored questions of spiritual practice among the clergy, but encouraged the bishops to give their priests greater freedom. I quote, "There is little indication that American priests would exercise freedom in an impulsive or destructive way," unquote. This, of course, if the statistics are any guide, was precisely the historical moment when clerical sexual abuse was increasing at a terrifying rate. Kennedy himself left the priesthood in 1977. The question of moral teaching is central to the phenomenon of clerical abuse. In order for the abuser to justify the abuse to himself and to others, and in order for superiors to justify to themselves ignoring the complaints, it is necessary for them to take the view that the terrible crimes being committed are not, in fact, very serious at all. Sometimes, indeed, we hear from abusers the abuse was actually good for the victims. It is an example of this to which I turn in the penultimate section. Section 5, Abuse and the Liturgy. Not all abuse is sexual abuse. Systematic emotional and spiritual abuse are also possible. It is sometimes suggested that a driver of clerical abuse is a homosexual network within church institutions. It is true that a large proportion of sexual abuse which has taken place in the Catholic institutions in Europe and North America has been against adolescent males and young men. Although at the time of writing, there are increasing indications of the systematic sexual abuse of religious sisters by priests in India and Africa. However, many kinds of abuse have flourished and have been afforded the same protection as in the case described above, of an emotional abuser and sexual abuser being treated exactly alike by the same superior. What unites the phenomenon is the abuse itself. In this section, I want to take the principle of abuse into a new area altogether, the liturgy. Liturgical abuse is truly an abuse of the faithful, who are deprived of access to the sacraments in a dignified setting and are subjected to the whims of priests and their favoured lay assistants. I know some listeners, perhaps not in this room, but when I publish this online, some listeners will be amused by the idea of taking liturgical abuse seriously, or perhaps offended by my drawing a parallel with sexual abuse. To make my point, I do not need to claim that liturgical abuse is on the same level of seriousness as sexual abuse, simply that it illustrates an attitude of disregard towards victim sufferings, which is also found in other kinds of case. Nevertheless, in its worst forms, it can be a psychologically and spiritually manipulative, exhibiting many of the features of sexual abuse. In Goodbye, Good Men, Michael Rose quotes Father Andrew Walter of Bridgeport Diocese, speaking about St. Mary's Seminary in Baltimore. Anyone who's read this book will know that the vast majority of the quotations and incidents that he describes, he is unable to tell you where they happened or who was talking to him. So this is much more powerful piece of testimony than most of what's found in the book. And I quote Father Walter. "Some seminarians were very reverent and pious towards the Eucharist. And one day at Mass, after communion had been distributed, a faculty priest blew on the pattern where there were fingernail-sized pieces of the Eucharist on it. He did this to make a point to the guys who were pious, who believed in the teaching of the church, that Jesus is really present in the host. He was saying to the seminarians, why are you so rigid? I'm not going to say this is verging on the demonic. That is demonic. So that's Father Walter. This is an example of psychological abuse using the liturgy as a means. The perpetrator, however, would no doubt justify it as something good for the victims, something helpful to free them from their hang-ups. Exactly the same kind of self-justification is sometimes made by priestly sex abusers who have imbibed progressive theories of sexuality. In both cases, the end result can include the victim's loss of faith. Liturgical abuses have, of course, been condemned by successive popes, but the bishops of the world generally ignore complaints, apparently impervious to the spiritual suffering it causes to their flocks. They sometimes react to abuses which threaten the sacramental validity of the rite, but it is difficult to think of bishops anywhere, really, who have gone further than this and attempted to stamp out liturgical abuses on principle. Pope John Paul II himself, who oversaw many documents condemning abuses in the strongest terms, set the tone when he allowed himself to be blessed by a pagan priestess in Mexico City in 2002. And of course, there are other examples. Bishops ignoring victims of clerical abuse is what one would expect from the Cardinal O'Connell system described by Philip Lawler earlier. We see the same thing in the context of liturgical reform itself. The laity were not consulted, and many enthusiasts for the reform admitted that the laity had no desire for it. Thus, the English liturgical progressive Father Clifford Harrell wrote in 1966, I quote, this is a letter in the... No, this is a book he wrote. In this country, the people at large have not desired to have English in the liturgy because our liturgical movement has lagged far behind that of the continent. Until very recently, only a minority knew enough about the liturgy to realise that full, active and intelligent participation in it cannot be attained by the use of Latin alone. Unquote. In other words, they don't want it, they should want it, they're going to guess it, whether they like it or not. Looking at the letters pages of the Catholic press from the mid-1960s to the early 1970s, as I have been recently researching another book, the suffering experienced by the laity as a result of the reform is also very clear and heartbreaking. The reformers assumed that the laity would come round to it and that in the end it would be good for them. But in any case, the concerns of the laity seem to have had very little weight. The traditionalist English priest Father Brian Houghton wrote, I quote, the new reforms in general, and of the liturgy in particular, were based on the assumption that the Catholic laity were a set of ignorant fools. Houghton goes on, I quote, what passes belief is that I know of no book or article published within the last 20 years, he's writing in the 90s, extolling the virtues and commiserating the sufferings of the Catholic laity. If they dared to remonstrate, they were told merely that they were divisive, disloyal, and disobedient. Actually, that was 1987, Judith's Marriage. I recommend the book. It's been reprinted. Having said all this, there is, in fact, a particular group of complaints which, typically, bishops have not been ignoring in the post-conciliar period. They tweaked the clericalist O'Connell system to produce an ideologically slanted result. Those who want to associate clericalism with theological conservatism will be disappointed to see, however, that the complaints bishops have tended not to ignore are not those from conservatives, but those from radical progressives. Lay complaints that priests are inventing their own Eucharistic prayers, using invalid matter for Mass, invalidly baptizing babies, and other abuses so serious that on many occasions the Holy See had to become involved, have frequently been ignored or downplayed by the responsible bishop for years and sometimes for decades. By contrast, complaints that priests were celebrating the Novus Ordo Mass in a more conservative way, such as celebrating Ad Orientem, failing to use female altar servers or using Latin, all things permitted by the liturgical rules, frequently led to swift and harsh responses. This happened above all when priests wished to celebrate the traditional Mass. Very public examples of this tendency have been seen in the wake of Pope Francis' Apostolic Letter Traditionis Custodes of 2021. This document restricts celebration of the traditional Mass, but it has occasioned restrictions by various bishops of liturgical practices within the rules of the Novus Ordo, such as those just mentioned, or even the use of Roman-style vestments in Puerto Rico. There is no indication that practical steps are being taken against common liturgical abuses. An example from an earlier period of the post-conciliar age is given by a report from a press conference addressed by Archbishop Rembert Weakland in his capacity as the head of the Bishops' Conference on Liturgy in the United States in 1979. So Weakland, of course, was himself an abuser, using diocesan funds to pay off what he would describe as his homosexual lover, and what the individual concerned would describe as his abusive relationship. So a journalist present on this occasion in 1979, John Molloy, not a traditionalist, but a journalist, noted Weakland's expression of sympathy for those who changed the words of the liturgy against the rules because of their desire to use inclusive language. Molloy took the opportunity to ask Weakland about those Catholics who, again against the rules of the time, attended the traditional Mass. And here I quote Molloy. It became apparent that only those who objected to what they called sexist language in the liturgy were the object of the Archbishop's sympathy. It was only those people he had in mind when he spoke of the need for action to, quoting Weakland, to alleviate any hurt or feeling of alienation of a large segment of the assembly, unquote. Not those who wished to retain the liturgy in the Tridentine form. So far as Archbishop Weakland was concerned, these latter had no call upon him whatsoever. They had shown by their disobedience to liturgical norms that they were outside the church community for which the Archbishop felt a responsibility, unquote. Strikingly, this tendency to give weight to complaints coming from liturgical progressives, but not to those of liturgical conservatives, is found not only among bishops who personally favour progressive liturgies, but also among many of the more conservative ones. They appear to feel themselves prisoners of a consensus in favour of a progressive liturgy, enforced by a combination of their own senior priests, their fellow bishops, and the noisiest elements of Catholic public opinion. As early as 1964, John Cardinal Heenan expressed the problem in a letter to the novelist Evelyn Waugh, with whom he was on friendly terms. I quote Heenan. The hierarchy is in a difficult position. We have not yet lost the respect of ordinary Catholics, but the constant nagging of the intellectuals and their tiresome letters to the press and articles in the Catholic papers may eventually disturb the ordinary faithful. Most of us would be content to delay changes, but the mood of the council compels us to act. Otherwise, the attack from our own people would become ever more bitter. Inimici hominis domestici scies. So that's a misquotation, as a matter of fact, from Matthew 10:36, a man's enemies shall be of his own household. The Welsh novelist Alice Thomas Ellis expressed it less sympathetically some decades later, writing in sometime before 2004. Catholic bishops at the moment remind me of those shy, wild animals you occasionally glimpse a glimpse of, wide-eyed in the headlights, before they scurry back to the hedgerow and the security of their own kind. They detest scrutiny, evade questioning, and refuse to explain the twists and perversions of doctrine they seek to impose. Good old Alice Thomas Ellis. Exceptions to these generalisations exist, but they are few, and they have suffered for it in terms of their relations with their fellow bishops, attacks by the liberal Catholic press, and even the loss of office. The more common attitude expressed by Cardinal Heenan appears to substitute the good opinion of an elite for the good of those they govern. and is reminiscent of the phenomenon of the weak ego conformism I have discussed elsewhere. It is also an indication of the way bishops and others in authority are integrated into an abusive network. They don't have to agree with the abuse themselves, but somehow the system not only makes it impossible for them to do anything about it, but actually co-opts them to act to prevent anyone else undermining the system. Catholics must unfortunately thank journalists and the secular legal system for exposing at least important aspects of the grotesque system of abuse under which we have suffered for so long. So this is the final section, the church as an abusive network. To draw the threads of this paper together, the evidence of the last decade or so has put to rest, at least for the minimally honest observer, the idea that clerical abuse is typically associated with sexually repressed conservative Catholic clergy. We need an understanding of the phenomenon that can accommodate Jean Vianney and, for that matter, Harvey Weinstein. The same evidence should also put the role of homosexuality into context. It is not surprising that a lot of clerical abusers have been same-sex attracted, because for them, the Catholic Church, with its seminaries, altar servers and schools, represents a target-rich environment, albeit less so today than 30 years ago. As I have noted, however, the patterns of abuse and cover-up are identical, whether the victims are boys, seminarians, adult women, or ordinary pew sitters. This is not to say that there is not a problem with homosexuality in the church. It is simply that it is not the key to understanding the abuse problem, since the abuse problem manifests itself in cases where homosexuality is not present. Similarly, what has happened in the church with clerical abusers has happened with non-clerical abusers and has happened outside the church. Again, this is not to say there is no problem with clericalism, but it is not the key to understanding the problem, because the problem can manifest itself inside and outside the church where clerics are absent. So, what is the heart of the problem? I would like to set out three ideas and make a tentative suggestion about the genesis of the crisis. The first idea is the pyramid of abuse. This is what we find in a classic abusive cult, a network of abuse in its purest form. The person at the apex abuses those further down, but they put up with this and cover it up, wholly or partly because their superiors tolerate and cover up their own abuse of subordinates, the people at the bottom of the pyramid. The people at the bottom are there because they think the institution does some good, and or because they have become so identified with the institution that they can't bear to leave if, in classic cult fashion, they have been cut off from their friends and family outside the cult. Nevertheless, there is typically a high turnover at the bottom, and cults are constantly engaged in recruitment to keep things going. It is important to note that the pyramid model can work with any kind of abuse. The second idea is this. The Catholic Church, the BBC and the other institutions that have been making the headlines about abuse over the last decade or so differ from the pyramid model, in as much as the people at the top, who are the most active covering abuse up, are not necessarily abusers themselves. The BBC managers who protected Jimmy Savile were not usually sociopathic paedophiles. To take another case, what madness led NHS managers cover up for the serial killer nurse, Lucy Letby? Why take the appalling risk to their own reputations of consistently ignoring warnings and delaying and obstructing investigations? We may ask the same question of Catholic bishops and religious superiors. This is the key puzzle of the whole question. Yes, sometimes abusers are popular, have influential friends, or have powers of blackmail. But equally, many of them are pathetic specimens, miserable, isolated, and broken by accusations. I say this having met a few. The answer is not that flushing out abusers would harm the prestige of the institution. Prosecuting them publicly might indeed be embarrassing, but nothing is simpler or more risk-free than for an employer or superior to brandish a thick file of accusations at an abuser and get him to go quietly into retirement. In vast numbers of cases, however, this is not what they did. Instead, they prolonged the abuse by shutting down investigations, fobbing off whistleblowers, and providing the abuser with fresh victims. It is perfectly obvious that over time, this policy raises the risk of exposure by the press or the courts to higher and higher levels until, in many cases, it finally becomes public. So, that is the problem. The third idea is my solution. Rational people tolerate risks in order to achieve some good result. What cover-up bishops and the managers of other institutions have been doing is protecting their own power within the institution. In any institution, the loyalty and obedience of subordinates is maintained by some kind of reward given by superiors. In secular institutions, this is usually money, but money can be supplemented or replaced by many other things, such as opportunities for abuse or protection against complaints. Protecting abusive subordinates is a good way for managers to ensure that an important section of subordinates are loyal and uncomplaining. Once the culture of abuse is established, more and more strong people strongly motivated in this way will be drawn into the institution, and the people not wanting to play along will be marginalised, rendered powerless, and leave. Now, recall the pyramid of abuse model. As I noted, the church and the BBC and so on seem to differ from this simple abuse network model because the incentive, the psychological payoff for people at different levels of the pyramid isn't typically not the same. For the abusers in the middle ranks, it may be sexual gratification. For the guy at the top, as I have just suggested, it may be the ability to wield power and make himself comfortable. Then again, if the toleration of abuse is motivated by a manager's desire to maintain control and not to engage in the same kind of abuse himself, then it won't matter what kind of abuse the middle-ranking people are getting up to. Sexual, emotional, spiritual abuse, or come to that, the misappropriation of funds. It makes no difference. If it makes the abuser more pliable, grateful, and loyal to the superior. The church and the other institutions then differ from a purpose-made child sex abuse cult in this way. But on closer inspection, in a broad sense, they can still be regarded as pyramids of abuse when one remembers that protecting abusers and fobbing off victims is itself a form of abuse. As Catholics, we can add that using high office in the church as a means to worldly satisfactions is an abuse of office. Of course, superiors won't say they are acting to maximise loyalty for their own benefit. They will say they are looking after their priests or other subordinates and trying to provide them with tasks that they will make themselves useful and find contentment. This, however, is just another way of saying that they are continuing not only not to shop their priests to the police, but actually to give them new opportunities for abuse, like a great plate of meat. What explains this highly risky behaviour is the need to maintain power within the institution. Clearly, there are many elements of this highly complex situation which my model does not explain, which are due to factors I have not discussed, such as the revolution in attitudes towards sexual sins and the persecution of liturgical conservatives. However, I think my model explains an important element in what has been going on. Crucially, if one lumps together all forms of abuse in the church, including the spiritual abuse of entire congregations through the manipulation of the liturgy, one can see that the abuse is not just a matter of a few bad apples. In the church, since the 1960s, the pattern of abuse and the protection of abusers has been endemic. My final question is a chronological one. Why did this happen when it did? Well, the liturgical revolution of the second half of the 1960s was accompanied by a revolution in priestly spirituality and identity, which destroyed the traditional self-understanding of priests and the confidence that had once existed that they were engaged in something meaningful that only they could do. Vocations collapsed, A wave of priests left ministry, and those who remained suffered poor morale. I will simply observe at the end of this discussion that it is not surprising if bishops and superiors cast around at that moment for new ways of engaging the loyalty of their priests in an attempt to stabilise the situation. The O'Connell model of ignoring lay complaints was already well established. The secular world was telling them that sexual abuse was a mere peccadillo and perhaps even a liberating experience for the victim. Why not just let priests so inclined alone and give them new assignments as necessary in return for some measure of loyalty and gratitude? If I'm correct, the flip side of my explanation is that as it becomes harder to tolerate abusive priests, thanks to the interest of the media and prosecutors, levels of clerical disobedience and general chaos in the church will actually increase. We shall see. If it does, we can comfort ourselves with the thought that disorder is better than an order based on cruelty and lust.
This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.